if you've read the bio on the program there, then you know where he's from, Los Angeles, then El Paso, then Austin. And you know also that he's won the Penn Hemingway Award, a Guggenheim, a Whiting. You can read his work in college texts and in places like The New Yorker and Harper's. You may not know other things, like that when I was in graduate school in Texas, he was my teacher. And that one night at a bar after class, that good start? He told me, upon my questioning to him of how to go about getting published in prestigious literary journals, he told me, "Just do the work, Glenn." I didn't really listen all that well that night, but later on, I finally did listen. So I'm forever grateful to him for that. Tonight, you can listen to his words. And they are pure and true words. My graduate fiction workshop can probably attest to that. We just had class 4 to 7 over in Colson. And Dagoberto came, we listened, we talked, we bullshitted a little bit. It was a good time. As far as after tonight, after you've listened, you can do other things. I blogged for the first time ever this week on the department blog about Dagoberto coming. And a few things I pointed out, although I don't think I pointed out this one, but you can do other things after tonight, like go out and get your hands on this book. This is a hell of a book. This is H.O. and Tejas. It's an anthology of Texas Mexican literature, edited by Dagoberto Gil. You can do other things, like check out a documentary that originally aired as part of the PBS Independent Lens series, I believe. It's called Writ Writer. I blogged about that this week, too. If you want to know about the power of words, check out a documentary called Writ Writer, for which Dagoberto wrote the script. You can do other things like get on Google or other news places and check out what's going on in Arizona in the Tucson Unified School District, where Dagoberto's books are among those being banned.
Yay!
See, now you know you're in the right place. Now you know you're in the right place after you hear the word banned. So that's it. Please join me in welcoming Dagoberto Gil.
Well, I'm gonna sit here. I'm kind of, oh wow, that's bright. I'm pleased to be here. I'm real happy. Glenn owed me money, and you know, I'm here to collect. So he was my student. Enough said. No, actually, you know, he is a little more cleaned up. No, actually, none of that. And
less hair. Less hair.
Well, it's cut, isn't it? But it's a real pleasure to be here. Everybody's been kidding me because I said, boy, this reminds me of Northern California in the late 70s. And something wrong with this guy. And I'm like, God, maybe I don't know what hippies were like after all. I thought that looked like hippie. Maybe they looked like from West Virginia, and I didn't even know that all kind of white places look like hippies to me. I didn't know. I thought they were just hippies. I thought you were hippies. Aren't you hippies? No, anyway, I actually do think that, which is more evidence that I'm a little screwy. But, so what was I going to say? Anything else intelligent, so I at least leave a little better impression? Let's see, I mean, look at my clock. You're going to have to, one thing, vaguely serious, 7:20. I went through a brain injury a couple years ago, so I go through weird, not like, I don't have a twitches. That was funny to me. I'm sorry. I think I'm very funny, so if I just break out laughing, don't mind me. I just think I'm really humorous. Anyway, so I, but one of the things that happened is it kind of screwed up my vision. And you know, if you're, you know, you reach like 39 like me, your vision starts. I used to be able to see everything perfectly this way, but this I got the close up vision. I'm telling you too much. Just whatever. Here we go. The song I'm gonna read. I think the only thing I need to say about this piece is that it's set in Los Angeles. Yeah, I think that's it. It's called Uncle Rock. In the morning, ooh, that's loud. In the morning, at his favorite restaurant, is that two? Is that good?
Okay.
In the morning, at his favorite restaurant, Eric got to order his favorite American food, sausage and eggs and hash brown papitas, fried crunchy on top. He'd be sitting there eating with his mother, not bothering anybody, and life was good, when a man started changing it all. Lots of times it was just a man staring too much, but then one would come over. Friendly, he put his thick hands on the table as if he were touching water and squat low so that he was at sitting level, as though he were so polite, and he'd smile with coffee and tobacco-stained teeth. He might wear a bolo tie and speak in a drawl, or he might have on a tan uniform, a company logo on the back, an oval name patch on the front. Or he'd be in a nothing special work shirt, white or striped, with a couple of pins clipped onto the left side pocket, tucked into a pair of jeans or chinos that were morning clean still, with a pair of scuffed up work boots that laced up higher than regular shoes. He'd say something about her earrings or her bracelet or her hair or her eyes, or if she had on a white uniform, how nice it looked on her, or he'd come right out with it and tell her how pretty she was, how he couldn't keep himself from walking up, speaking to her, and could they speak again? Then he'd wink at Eric. Such a fine-looking boy. How old is he, 8 or 9? Eric wasn't even small for an 11-year-old. He tightened his jaw then, slanted his eyes up from his plate at his mom, and not the man, definitely not this man he did not care for. Eric drove a fork into the goopy American egg yolk and bled it into his American potatoes. She wouldn't offer the man Eric's correct age either, saying only that he was growing too fast. She almost always gave the man her number if he was wearing a suit. Not a sports coat, but a buttoned suit with a starched white shirt and a pin tie meant something to her. Once in a while, Eric saw one of these men again at the front door of their apartment in the Silver Lake. The man winked at Eric as if they were buddies, grabbed his shoulder or arm, squeezed the muscle against the bone. What did Eric want to be when he grew up? A cop? A jet airline mechanic? A travel agent? A court reporter? A dog groomer? Eric stood there, because his mom said he shouldn't be impolite. His mom's date said he wanted to take Eric along with him sometime, the three of them. What kind of places did Eric think were fun? Eric said nothing. He never said anything when the men were around, and not because of his English, even if that's what his mother implied to explain his silence. He didn't talk to any of the men, and he didn't talk much to his mother either. Finally, they took off, and Eric's night was his alone. He raced to the grocery store and bought a half gallon of chocolate ice cream. When he got back, he turned on the TV, scooted up real close as he could, and ate dinner with a soup spoon. He was away from all the men. Even though a man had given the TV to them, he was a salesman in an appliance store who'd bragged that a rich customer had given it to him, and why shouldn't he give it to Eric's mom, who couldn't afford such a good TV otherwise? When his mom was working as a restaurant hostess and was going to marry the owner, Eric ate hot fudge sundaes and drank chocolate shakes. When she worked at a trucking company, the owner of all the trucks told her he was getting a divorce. Eric climbed into the rigs with their rooms full of dials and levers in the sky. Then she started working in an engineer's office. There was no food or fun there, but even he could see the money. He was not supposed to touch anything, but what was there to touch? The tubes full of paper? He and his mom were invited to the engineer's house, where he had two horses and a stable, a swimming pool, and two convertible sports cars. The engineer's family was there, his grown children, his gray-haired parents. They all sat down for dinner in a dining room that that seemed bigger than Eric's apartment, with three candelabras at the table and a tablecloth and cloth napkins. Eric's mom took him aside to tell him to be well-mannered at the table and polite to everyone. Eric hadn't said anything. He never spoke to anyone, so how could he have said anything wrong? She leaned into his ear and said that he wanted them to know that he spoke English. The whole dinner, he was silent, chewing quietly, taking the smallest bites because he didn't want them to think that he liked their food. When she got upset about days like that, she told Eric that she wished she could just go back home. She was tired of worrying. Back, for Eric, meant mostly the stories he'd heard from her, which never sounded so good to him. She had to share a room with her brothers and sisters. They didn't have toilets. They didn't have electricity. Sometimes they didn't have enough food. He saw this Mexico as if it were a backdrop of a movie or on afternoon TV, where children walked around barefoot in the dirt or on broken sidewalks, and small men wore wide-brimmed straw hats and baggy white shirts and pants. The women went to church all the time and prayed to Alcove Saints and, heads down, fearful, counted rosary beads. There were rocks everywhere, and scorpions, and tarantulas, and rattlesnakes, and vultures, and no trees, and not much water, and skinny dogs, and donkeys, and ugly bad guys with guns and bullet vests who rode laughing in a town to drink and shoot off their pistols and rifles, driving their horses all over like dirt bikes on desert dunes. When they spoke English, they had stupid accents. His mom didn't have an accent like theirs. It didn't make sense to him that Mexico would only be like that, but what if it was close? He lived on paved, lighted streets, and a bicycle ride away were the Asian drugstore and the Armenian grocery store, and the corner where black Cubans drank coffee and talked Dodger baseball. When he was in bed, where he sometimes prayed, he thanked God for his mom, who he loved, and he apologized for not talking to her, or to anyone, really, except his friend Albert. And he apologized for never going to church and for his never taking Holy Communion, as Albert did, though only to God would he admit that he wanted to because Albert did. He prayed for good to come, for his mom and for him, since God was like magic, and happiness might come the way of early morning in the trees and bushes full of sparrows next to his open window, louder and louder when he listened hard, eyes closed. The engineer wouldn't have mattered if Eric hadn't told Albert that was his dad. Albert had just moved into the apartment next door and lived with both his mother and father. And since Albert's mother already didn't like Eric's mom, Eric told him that his new dad was an engineer. Eric actually believed it too and thought that he might even get his own horse. When that didn't happen and his mom was lying on the bed in the middle of the day blowing her nose, because she didn't even have a job anymore. That was when Roque what came around again. Roque was nobody, or he was anybody. He wasn't special. He wasn't not. He tried to speak in English to Eric, thinking that was the reason Eric didn't say anything when he was there. And Eric had to tell Albert that Roque was his uncle because the engineer was supposed to be his dad any minute. Uncle Rock, Eric said. His mom's brother, he told Albert. Roque worked at night and was around during the day, and one day he offered Eric and Albert a ride. When his mom got in the car and she scooted all the way over to Roque on the bench seat, who was supposed to be her brother, Eric's Uncle Rock. Albert didn't say anything, but he saw what had happened, and that was it for Eric. Albert had parents, grandparents, and a brother and a sister, and he'd hang out only when one of his cousins wasn't coming by. Eric didn't need a friend like him. What if she married Roque? His mom asked him one day, soon after. She told Eric that they would move away from the apartment in Silver Lake to a better neighborhood. He did want to move, but he wished that it weren't because of Uncle Rock. It wasn't just because Roque didn't have a swimming pool or horses or a big ranch house. There wasn't much to criticize except that he was always too willing and nice, too considerate, too generous. He was nothing flashy or expensive, just ordinary clothes that were clean and ironed, and shoes he kept shined. He combed and parted his hair neatly. Didn't have a buzz cut like the men who didn't like kids. He moved slow. He talked slow, so as quiet as night. He only ever said yes to Eric's mom. How could she not like him for that? He loved her so much, anybody could see his pride when he was with her. He signed checks and gave her cash. He knocked on the door carrying cans and fruit and meat. He was there when she asked, gone when she asked, back whenever, grateful. He took her to restaurants on Sunset, to the movies in Hollywood, or on drive to the beach in rich Santa Monica. Roque knew that Eric loved baseball. Did Roque like baseball? It was doubtful that he cared even a little bit. He didn't listen to games on the radio or TV, and he never looked at a newspaper. He loved boxing, though. He knew the names of all the Mexican boxers as if they lived here, as if they were Dodger players like Steve Yeager, Dusty Baker, Kenny Landrieu or Mike Marshall, Pedro Guerrero. Roque did know about Fernando Valenzuela. Everybody did, even his mom, which is why she agreed to let Roque take him to the game. What Mexican didn't love Fernando? Dodger Stadium was close to their apartment. He'd been there once when Albert and his family, well, outside it, a nearby hill, to the fireworks for 4th of July. His mom decided that all three of them would go on a Saturday afternoon, since Saturday night, Eric thought, she might want to go somewhere else, even with somebody else. Roque, of course, didn't know who the Phillies were. He knew nothing about the strikeouts by Steve Carlton or the home runs by Mike Schmidt. He'd never heard of Pete Rose. It wasn't that Eric knew very much either, but there was nothing that Roque could talk about, even if he were to talk. If Eric showed his excitement when they drove up to Dodger Stadium and parked, his mom and Roque didn't really notice it. They sat in the bleachers, and for him the green of the field was a magic light. The stadium lights surrounding them seemed as far away as Rome. His body was somewhere it had never been before. The fifth inning? That's how late they were. Or were they right on time? Because they weren't even sure they were sitting in the right seats, yet when he heard the crack of the bat, saw the crowd around them rising as it came at him, at them. Eric saw the ball. He had to stand and move and stretch his arms and want the ball until it hit his bare hands and stayed there. Everybody saw him catch it with no bobble. He felt all the eyes and voices around him as if there were every set of eyes and every voice in the stadium. His mom was saying something, and Roque too, and then finally it was just him and the ball in his stinging hands. He wasn't even sure if it had been hit by Pete Guerrero. He thought for sure it had been, but he didn't ask. He didn't watch the game then. He couldn't. He didn't care who won. He stared at his official National League ball, reimagining what had happened. He ate a hot dog and drank a soda, and he sucked the salted peanuts in the wooden spoon from the chocolate malt ice cream. He rubbed the bumpy seams of the home run ball. Game over, they were the last to leave. People were hanging around, not going straight to their cars. Roque didn't want to leave. He didn't want to end so quickly, Eric thought, while he still had her with him. Then one of the Phillies came out of the stadium door and people swarmed, boys mostly, but also men and some women and girls, and they got autographs before the players climbed onto the team's bus. Joe Morgan, they said. Then Gary Maddox appeared. Eric clutched the ball, but he didn't have a pin. He just watched, his back to the gray bus the Phillies were getting into. Then a window slid open. "Hey, big man," a voice said. Eric really wasn't sure. "Give me the ball, la pelota," the face in the bus said. I'll have it signed, comprendes? Echalo, just toss it to me, Eric. Eric obeyed. He tossed it up to the hand that was reaching out. The window closed. The ball was gone for a while, so long that his mom came up to him, worried that he'd lost it. The window slid open again, and the voice spoke to her. "We got the ball, Mom. It's not lost. Just a few more." When the window open once more, this time the ball was there. "Catch!" There were all kinds of signatures on it, though none that he could really recognize except for Joe Morgan and Pete Rose. Then the voice offered more, and the hand then threw something at him. "For your mom, okay? Comprendes?" Eric stared at the asphalt lot where the object lay, as if he'd never seen a folded-up piece of paper before. "Para tu mamá, bueno?" He picked it up, and he started to walk over to his mom and Roque, who were so busy talking they hadn't noticed anything. Then he stopped. He opened the note himself. No one said he couldn't read it. It said, "I'd like to get to know you. You are muy linda, very beautiful and sexy. I don't speak Spanish very good, but maybe you speak better English, pero no importa. Would you come by tonight and let me buy you a drink?" There was a phone number on a hotel room, a name too, a name that came at him the way the home run had. Eric couldn't hear. He could only see his mom ahead of him. She was talking to Roque. Roque was talking to her. Roque was the proudest man, full of joy because he was with her. It wasn't his fault he wasn't an engineer. Now Eric could hear again. Like sparrows hunting seed, boys gathered around the bus, calling out, while the voice in the bus was yelling at him, "Hey, big guy, give it to her." Eric had the ball in one hand and the note in the other. By the time he reached his mom and Roque, the note was already somewhere on the asphalt parking lot. "Look," he said in a full voice, "they signed my ball." You know, I always like to. I tend to like to read funny ones, and the reason I like to is because people buy more books. Nothing personal, but you guys all tend to be cheap. It's not really your fault. It's everybody's cheap now. I don't know. Nobody wants to buy books, but you should consider buying. If not my book, buy a book. It's really becoming a scary phenomenon that we don't have books for sale and people don't want them. Although I do see these Kindles and the iPad, so that's cool. I guess that's cool. Yeah, anyway, this isn't very funny either. That's why I bring that up. I wrote this one for a book, an anthology of, you know, I don't know if you've heard of WPA, the Writers Project, and I was asked to write a piece on, they picked 50 writers, and each writer got a state, and first I got Texas, and then the editor, that Matt guy, as a matter of fact, the editor asked me, would I mind doing Iowa? Which seemed very appropriate to me. But ironically, it seemed perfect for me. And the reason it was perfect is because I wanted to write about corn. And Iowa's absolutely perfect for corn. And now, I'm not going to read the entire thing because it would be too long, and I'm hoping I don't read too long because I know you have very good questions to ask me, and I have nothing but profound and interesting answers. But I'm going to read this. I'm just getting in the story. It's about, in fact, the WPA, the whole point was to go out and meet people in a community and record what they say, what you learn from the community. That was the 30s project. It was FDR was hated for this. It was proof that he was a commie because he actually wanted writers to go out and record poor people and how they lived. It generated horrible, horrible commie writers like Studs Terkel and Richard Wright and Ralph Ellison. It was, you know, an incredible blooming of an American literature that I, for one, miss. But I went out to Iowa and I decided to find out about corn. So I'm jumping in. The leaves of a corn star, let's go. The leaves of the corn stalks are waxy, veined, like a narrow palm, and the two sides of each leaf peel away and fall away from its spine as they grow out. Water can funnel right into the creases like halved paper, run down the stalk, drench the shallow roots until they are long enough to drop delicately, tenderly at their endpoints. Their stalks are bamboo thin and knuckled, and here, already at least as tall as I am. And though I can see through them and past, a green patina rustles more than its leaves, but is a light casting through like a mist. And it's the blue sky that you begin to see better. Blue as in an imagined heaven. Blue that isn't only the sky, but is this earth as close as the green, as the tallest green stalks and the leaves touching it. And it is noticeably more blue because it rests on top of the cornfield. How to make a commercial tortilla. There are 55 gallon drums. No, let me do that. There are 15 55 gallon drums. And every night the corn soaks from 4 to 5 hours, bubbling under 15 burners, and they are stirred with paddles that are like from a rowboat. After a while, using a can of a measured size. Lime is scooped out of its sacks and mixed in and stirred and stirred. A foam like from the ocean rises, which means it's working, breaking down the corn right so it'll be healthy to eat. Then the corn rests a few hours, warm still, tin buckets with holes on the bottom, both takes out the corn and drains the water so that it can be ground in the molino, where stone turns it into, where stones turn it into masa. Now I ball the size of a watermelon. It's fed between twin rollers, which flatten the dough into a conveyor where it is cut. This raw tortilla falls onto a traveling grill, cooking one side, then falls to another, flipping it to its other side for grilling until it falls onto one more belt, which drops it onto a cook stack. Women pick them up from there, counting them onto a waxed paper. They wrap the paper up and around the counted piles and flip the package over. In, say, Corpus Christi, Texas, it might have charro tortillas printed on the paper and stack them in a box for delivery. Because this is about the tortilla. This is about corn grown in Iowa. This is about the people who are in the campos of Iowa picking the vegetables and walking the cornfields. These people are Mexican people. They are of the culture where hand-ground masa was first patted into tortillas, and because of that, it is said that the physical body of any Mexicano is at least half corn. They are from the civilization that worshipped the corn plant as a god in some regions, such as what became Guatemala, the god, the image of God. And they are from the soil and nation where the corn we have all learned to eat and to feed as grain for healthy livestock was first developed and harvested 5,000 years ago. They are the people who are now driven here because even corn and the tortilla is going up in price since the 90s NAFTA treaty, and subsidized corn in the United States is cheaper to import, while its demand raises its value to the corporate farmers in Mexico. Because corn has become an ethanol fuel industry, its hybrid grain is even more wanted. In Mexico, the ordinary milpas, cornfields, are shrinking in size, and those people who traditionally work them can't make enough to survive in their villages, and so they are leaving like animals in a drought, going to the big cities to find jobs. And they are crossing the border because that's where most jobs are. They have come even to Iowa because they will be hired and work in meatpacking plants cheaply, hard, and they will work in the fields cheaply and hard. And as they walk las milpas in Iowa to do as their culture has for thousands of years, anti-immigration ideologues bash them for spoiling what they see as their field of dreams, as clean and pure as Iowa butter, as nostalgic as baseball, as all-American as Kevin Costner. Becky is my ride to the cornfield being walked. It's known by a field number, the digits as natural and recognizable to the people as a pet's name. Her blue pickup loaded with iced sodas and a chest of lonches. She wants to know why it has to be her who takes me, and she isn't entirely joking. She's a big Iowa woman, a 60s grown-up, born and raised not far away, rooted to the driver's seat. Her tattoos barely seen under the brown sunburn of her fleshy upper arms. She also works biker gatherings and just retired from the clerical staff at the university. It's a few ranch roads to where we go, a route that crosses the rich Iowa River and would lead us to Mescatine, talking about the men bunking in the schoolhouse, she says she cannot imagine the raunch of it. Sweat and dirty socks, snores, farts from those beans. Who'd be able to stand all those men, she asks. She pauses. Then again, she might. She might, she tells me, smiling, because she's so dirty-minded. We pull onto the dirt farm road where dust rises from behind like the blow of bad rings and step alongside the cornfield near the rented yellow school bus that transports the workers. Tom Bell's son is there to wave at us from his pickup. He's on the phone, as busy as his dad. Men too short to be seen inside the tall corn jungle begin to emerge. No factory whistle, and it's not like a construction site either, where it's a certain hour and everyone stops everything. Mostly in pairs, the campesinos exit slowly, unrushed, from the world of the surcos, rows, bandanas under their hats to wrap their necks, bandanas and dark glasses masking their faces. A few have mosquito netting and long sleeve shirts and gloves, their mochila, a day bag or a plastic store bag to carry in an extra shirt or a rain poncho or some rubber boots, and their own personal valuables slung on their back or in their hand. On their belt hangs a rubber clip for a soda bottle to carry water. The gloves and bottle hook are gifts from Bell's detasseling. They get their lonche from the ice chest, a caldo of pork, pineapple, and bell pepper, a fresh jalapeno tortilla still warm and foiled. A few men go inside to sit onto the soft seats there, a few against the side of the bus in a slant of shade. I go over to three who rest at the back to the water igloo, taking their time before they eat. I tell them how they all look like Subcomandante Marcos coming out of the jungle. After a moment to absorb my humor, they each look at each other and finally grin. They are from Monterrey, young, though one must be closer to 30 than the other two. None of them have crossed the U.S.-Mexican border before now. Only one of them has worked in agriculture previously, but this isn't hard work except for the long hours. Though it isn't so hot yet, even with the long sleeve shirts they have to wear. The fields aren't too muddy. The mosquitoes haven't gotten so bad yet. Jobs are hard to find over there, and it's never enough. The youngest one talks about working in garages and restaurants. There's a lot of danger to other things. The older one says how running with movidas might seem good for a little bit, but it's not worth the trouble. The work is good for them, even if it's only a month. We are looking at the sky, more Hollywood design and concept than Iowa. The clouds, too white, too flawlessly shaded gray to be believed, too beautiful. The older one asks about me, and I tell them how I was born in Los Angeles and worked construction. Even through their mirrored glasses, I see their eyes go starry. I mention El Paso and the capital, Austin, and how in Dallas, and how in Houston, and as though I am speaking of mythical lands. I gesture to the east and tell them over there is where Chicago is, very close. The youngest one jokes how fast they could get there. The other two aren't even considering it, though the third, quiet one, takes a couple of steps in that direction to see that much closer. This is good for now, the older says. It's what they have. After a pause, the younger one returns, sincerely, así es la vida. We drive to another field, more masked campesinos breaking through the corn jungle row unexcitedly, unhurried, to talk to take lunch. The conversations are muted. Music they like and don't. Other places they've been. Muted like they are far away. On the field, the crew chief has them leave their mochila at the beginning of each row, and all but three have been picked up. When most have finished eating, two of the stragglers appear and nod, pleased about where to find the lunch. 20 minutes later, the last one, Oscar, unmasked, finally comes out just as the other two go back to work. Maybe 18, maybe 21. Unlike the others I've seen so far, he is overweight in the soft manner of a good boy from El Paso or San Antonio, playing too many video games in front of a TV with soda, candies, and Doritos. His slow is tired, but also much more lost, miserable, mom sick. And he can barely speak, though he does a thank you when he is told where he will find his lonche. When he is done eating, maybe he does take an entire half an hour, but certainly no more. He ends his lunch break in the same self-absorbed, unself-conscious way he began, stepping back like his feet hurt to the line of surcos where the others have been for some time out of sight already. The rows of the milpas have been mowed earlier so that they are all of an even height. They are arranged so that one male plant from one seed will pollinate at least two females grown from a different seed on either side of it, so that the layout is four rows of female, a male row, four female, a male, and so on. The leaves of the first male stalk is sprayed a day glow orange. The men must know which it is because its espigas, its tassels, are the only ones that must be left untouched. It is their pollen which will reach the female silks below, which will grow the kernels on the cob, a new third seed which will be harvested. Corn carries with it both male and female parts. And what the campesinos are doing is yanking off the male parts from the ones in the rows of four. One, on a first pass, men pull this shaft out of its stalk, the one blooming and unpollinating tassel from its node, effectively castrating the plant, leaving the cañahote behind. The tassel snaps out easily, a juiced, fleshy pop that sounds not unlike cracking a knuckle, and is dropped onto the dirt of the surco. After a second pass through, there is yet a third, this one crosswise, made by a more seasoned chequeador, a checker, who looks for misses. Wrapped in the same leaf husk as the ripened female corn on the cob we all know, peeled away, it looks much like a young rye or wheat, only deep green and huskier. When left to bloom, the sun on it, the green becomes a golden yellow pollen sticky, though not as sticky as the white female silks waiting beneath. The field has to be 99.7 to 99.8 percent detasseled for the crop to germinate the exact corn seed it is hoped for. 5,000 years of walking las milpas in Mexico, the descendants of those people are now in Iowa, a most Americana of American states, and walking cornfields, attending to this cross-fertilization work considered spiritual way, way back then. Iowa's Mexicans are only a little more aware of corn's history as those in Iowa are. It's as though the migration of the Mexican deity itself has finally summoned its native worshippers to tend to it, populating the soil it grows in. I asked Becky, 10, 15 years ago, it would be high school and college boys and girls from the towns here. It was not only a summer ritual, but a good income for the summer. Now you have to hire as many as you can because only half stay with it. They are too hot. They are too sunburned. One doesn't want to work past 2 p.m. Another says she can't. One wants to rest a day because he got too tired the day before. It's the weekend. Or it's because it's just the week. It was just the weekend and he wants to sleep in. One has to babysit on certain days, and then maybe the next just doesn't feel like showing up at all. And then there's the other smaller issues. If someone's litter from lunch gets left behind, for instance, you ask one to pick it up. It's not mine, is the answer. Pick it up anyway. It's not mine. Okay, but pick it up anyway. I didn't leave that. Just pick it up. There is no litter in these campos. And these Mexicanos are so polite, and they work until they are told it is time to stop. There are a lot more cornfields than there used to be, and there wouldn't be enough Iowa people around who would work the fields, even if. To be at the school buses at 4:30 a.m., you have to get up and go even earlier. It's dark then, the rising sun in the east, an ember of blue light, so pure it calms all its sight, the only nature visible except when a stray head or tail light flashed by on its sizzling highway. The buses idling, the campesinos, their mochila hung on their shoulders, their work IDs looped to their neck, find their way inside the buses they are assigned. So effortless and still, it's almost like nature itself. And after these men have gone, a couple of men who stay behind greet me as they are walking out of the kitchen with a styrofoam cup of coffee steaming. The first one is named Raul, and he's originally from Big Spring, Texas. Been in Conesville for so many years now, he's for Iowa football and thinks this year they'll beat Texas. His job is as a translator, and he tells me it's the best job he's ever had. When his wife and two teenage children drive up in a pickup, they're working for the Bells too. He introduces them all to me, switching into English. His wife, a native Iowan, he'd met when he first came up here for work. His children, sleepy as they are nothing but polite. They are Iowans. When he takes off with them, it's Alejandro who comes over. Alex is what they call him. Alejandro is the man who Tom Bell probably counts on the most. This is his fifth year here now, and he is employed at least a month before the other workers, and at least a month after, always the longest. When three men pile out of the bunkhouse at 5 a.m., it's him who's shaking his head at them. He told them at 4:30, and now there's no ride until 6:30. They wait over on the school steps. Alejandro is from Nayarit, which is on the Pacific side of Mexico, a long way from a bus depot in Monterrey. He's picked everything, he tells me proudly, every fruit and every vegetable. Just before he came here, he'd been working in a sugarcane factory back home. This is a good job, he tells me. He'll come back as often as he can. Mr. Bell treats him well, treats them all well. When somebody can't take it, can't make it out here, I ask. It happens, and they find something around the grounds for them to do. It all works out. It is dawn now, blue-gray, more people, more talk, no more indoor light needed. Alejandro yells it over to those guys sitting. He tells them they can get a ride in the pickup that just pulled up, that it's going to their field, to not forget in to forget to check in with our crew chief. 6'5" high, Alejandro is as tall and lean as the healthiest Iowa cornstalk. As native of Mexico as maíz, and he is right in the middle of the field of dreams. Thank you so much.